Good Monday morning and welcome to Jump in Tucson. I am your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley. In studio with me is my executive assistant, Morgan Murphy. Good morning, Morgan.
Good morning, Dr. Ackerley.
We got a fascinating show today to talk about some good things going on at the University of Arizona. Jump in Tucson highlights those great things on Monday. We call it the Wonder Show. We talk about the wonderful things happening at the University of Arizona. And one of those wonderful things that's happening at the U of A is our first guest, who is... Ufuoma Ovenmada. Did I do that right? Pretty close, huh? Okay, well, welcome to you, and welcome to Jump in Tucson.
Hi, thanks. Thanks. I'm really glad to be here.
Great. So before we get talking about this great program that you're working on in climate and the prison industry and so forth, let's talk a little bit about you and your educational journey and becoming a doctor and how you got to the University of Arizona and what you're doing there. So just talk a little bit about how you got to be with us here in Tucson.
Yeah, sure. So a lot of my background is actually in engineering. I did an undergraduate degree in mechanical engineering. And then when I graduated, I realized I didn't want a job quite yet. And I wanted to keep learning. And so I joined an interdisciplinary master's program at MIT. And at MIT, I ended up working with someone who studies applications of space technology like satellites and the ways that satellites collect a lot of measurements and information about the Earth that can be used to support decision making to help us be more sustainable and better manage our environment. And so that really captured my interest and ended up being the focus of my graduate studies. And I then pursued a degree in aeronautics and astronautics, also at MIT. And my focus ended up being on applications of satellite remote sensing for environmental justice, which I'm sure we'll talk about more later. Coming out of the degree, finishing my doctorate, I was really excited to join a department that would be a bit more multidisciplinary, leveraging both social sciences as well as the quantitative sciences. And the School of Geography, Development, Environment at Arizona seemed to do that really well. And so that's kind of what brought me to Tucson.
Great, and welcome. We're glad that you're here. So the Baker Prize then was something that kind of is helping you. And we're going to talk about two different things, that a fellowship, but also the Baker Prize. And we're going to talk about how that is helping you investigate the climate-driven discussion that we're going to have. But tell us what the Baker Prize is and kind of how that came into your life and why you're the recipient of the Baker Prize.
Yeah, so my understanding is there's a, anonymous donor who wants to help build capacity at the U of A as it relates to research, studying the impacts of climate change on humans, as well as how humans can better withstand the impacts of climate change and climate-related hazards. So that's generally the premise of the fellowship, and the fellowship provides support for a postdoc, I think, up to 2 years, as well as support to help them transition into a faculty position later on if they desire. I was really grateful to learn about the prize. I was already interested in U of A before that, but the prize just really, expanded the resources to allow me to join U of A, and has also given me the opportunity to really just craft my own research agenda rather than having to, work on a specific thing from a grant from, driven by another professor. I'm really getting to lead and craft my own research agenda.
And that anonymous gift was a $4 million gift to start with through the university's Fuel Wonder campaign. But it is interesting that it is anonymous and that you are... you don't know who the person is that gave the money, but yet you're using the money to good for the research that you're doing. So before we talk about the actual research that you're doing, I'm just interested that you have a doctorate in aeronautics, but you move from aeronautics and maybe even your engineering side of your life into advanced environmental justice. And we are going to talk about climate change in the U.S. prison system, but... Why did you kind of gravitate towards from that scientific viewpoint of aeronautics and engineering and so forth, that environmental justice, how do those two go together, and how does that become your passion?
Yeah, so I think really as early as, you know, being a child, being a young student in K through 12, I've always been really more interested in how science and technology can support humans than kind of just innovating on science and technology for the sake of innovation. And so I was always seeking connections to kind of human related or human impact or human centered design as it relates to technology and engineering. So in my master's, when I learned about satellites, prior to then, I really had no interest in space or space technology. But when I learned about satellites and the, like, you know, wealth, I can't even, you know, describe gigatons, bigger than gigatons of data that satellites collect about the Earth, about our land, about our water, about our atmosphere every single day, and the impact that that information can have to help to monitor deforestation or understand hurricane impacts or wildfires and all sorts of things that are very relevant and urgent to human well-being. I was really excited about that work. And then even more excited when realizing that so many people don't even know we have this information, that we have this data. And there's a lot of work that needs to happen to connect with decision makers, whether it be policymakers or indigenous groups or community-based advocacy organizations. There's a lot of work that needs to be done to connect with those folks to explain how this information is relevant and then do the interpretation analysis to make that information relevant to their daily lives. That work isn't necessarily engineering, right? It's right. Talking to humans, it's understanding their needs, it's translating their needs into science questions, and that's just where my passion ended up lying, and so I kind of just stuck with it and ran with it.
Very exciting. So when we come back after the break, what we'll talk about is this study that you're doing, which has to do with climate change and you know, the risks posed to prisons by extreme weather events, and again, that ties back into the social justice of how are we treating one another, and how is climate change affecting that. So we'll come back after the break and talk to you a little bit more about weather and climate and how people learn to grow and live in a changing world. So you're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI. We'll be back after a word from our great sponsors. And we'll be back to hear some more about climate change and the prison system on Jump in Tucson. Well, welcome back to Jump in Tucson. This is the Monday Wanderer edition, where we talk about the great things going on in research and outcomes and students and all the great things that are happening at the University of Arizona. With us is Dr. Ufuoma Ovenmada, who is a new doctor, but already jumping in a big way, taking on a Baker Prize of helping her do some research. And one of the things that you're going to be working on, or that you're working on right now, is how prisons are affected by extreme weather events, and as those that have intensified due to climate change, the vulnerability of these prisoners and prisons, the facilities themselves of which people live, obviously, and talking about that. So what moved you to think about the data that you're getting to kind of focus in on these prisons and prison life and the facilities that some of them maybe are antiquated, maybe 100-year-old prisons and so forth, and don't have the adequate climate control features that a brand new modern prison might have. So what brought you to this this thought process of looking at this?
Yeah, so during graduate school, I was already, you know, doing remote sensing science. At the time, I was focused, this is around 2020, I was focused on remote sensing of coastal ecosystems, so using satellite data to help identify invasive species in coastal ecosystems. And while I was really interested in that work, kind of as I mentioned earlier, I was always seeking like more and more direct kind of human impact and human relevance as it relates to the environment and technology. And I learned around at this time, I learned about prison ecology or prison environmental justice, this issue of prisons facing and being co-located with environmental hazards such as landfills, prisons being built on or adjacent to landfills, toxic waste facilities, as well as their infrastructural vulnerability as it pertains to climate-induced hazards. So, like hurricanes, just a few months when Hurricane Helene and Hurricane Milton were impacting the United States, we had to ask what is going on in the carceral facilities because there are no universal standards as it relates to evacuation procedures or, providing water, et cetera, during those times. So there have been multiple cases in history, Hurricane Harvey in Houston, Hurricane Katrina in Louisiana, where incarcerated people are sitting in water, sitting in flood water for days. And the list could go on. Extreme heat is a huge issue in prison facilities, with 44 states in the US not providing universal air conditioning in their prison facilities. And so, especially in light of climate change and worsening extreme weather conditions with heat, wildfires, hurricanes, it's a very pressing issue that I'm asking, as well as some of my colleagues, is how can we protect incarcerated people and give them more environments that are just have more dignity and safety?
So even some of these prisons, even the being built next to or on, say, a former dump for the city, or water can become a problem too, right? So their water is affected, and it's maybe not the first thing that someone thinks about, but if you're stuck in prison based on your sentence, and your only water you get is contaminated water, that could also be a result of exacerbated by hurricanes and other things too.
Exactly.
And so having some justice, some environmental justice for them is important. And you also think about prisons here in, say, the Southwest, where Tucson, Phoenix, and the outlying prisons in Florence and so forth, it does get to be 118, 120 degrees in the summertime. And some of these facilities were built, as I said, maybe 100 years ago, and they don't have the infrastructure for cooling that you would think. So this is when you start thinking about it, it becomes a pretty major problem.
Exactly. Yeah, I think I'm from Texas, and so I definitely know a thing or two about hot summers. And those summers are brutal, same in Arizona. And then you consider the fact that while me as a free person, I can change the clothes I'm wearing, I can go inside my home where I have central air conditioning. Incarcerated people are often at the whims of, their environments and of the prison guards. I've even heard cases in Texas where a facility has a designated air-conditioned room that people are supposed to be able to access if they're feeling too hot. But this person expressed to me being told no, that, just no. The guard was just neglecting their needs and not giving them access, which, yeah, it's brutal, and it can result in not just sickness, but actually death
Right.
in many cases.
And even some of these prison yards where they put the prisoners outside in tents and with no cooling. And so they're out in the weather with in extreme heat from as the temperature goes up, so does the temperature inside these outside tents, and there's no relief from that, even at night, trying to sleep when it's 80 degrees as opposed
Exactly.
to 62 degrees that we're comfortable sleeping in a hotel or whatever. So this becomes, you start again, if you start thinking about all the different ways that a prison complex can be affected by climate change and by natural disasters, earthquakes and tornadoes and hurricanes and so forth, it becomes kind of a complex problem. So that's why you're studying it, to see what the issues are across the country, right?
Exactly, yeah. So it's an issue that has been around. This isn't brand new. Folks have been living in these facilities with no relief for decades on decades at this point. However, because of, I think, social media, because of increased advocacy and increased data availability, we're starting to understand more, especially quantitatively, what is going on. And so the work that I'm doing is using satellite data to measure and map these environmental burdens and hazards that prisons are vulnerable to in the United States, and identifying which ones are facing the highest hazards, where are people maybe more vulnerable to then health risks and mortality impact, and so on. And my hope is also in connecting with advocacy organizations. I work with grassroots organizers across the United States who are interested in trying to intervene, change policy, et cetera, in these landscapes. And so my hope is that this data can be useful to help them craft their advocacy and inform policy.
As I'm listening to you here, you're talking about prisons in the United States of America, but now if you look globally and see what's happening, just the rough conditions that some prisoners live in, just in general. But then now you add climate change on top of that and exacerbates the problem globally. So yeah, your work is not done. There's a lot more to be done around the world. Let's talk just a little bit about this fellowship and as a springboard to rest of your professional career. You're a young doctor, you're brand new kind of to the research world as a doctor here, but you are got a lot of runway ahead of you in your career. What are you going to focus on in the future as you finish this work with the prisons and the environmental impact of climate change? What do you want to focus on in the future as you move forward?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I think right now I don't really see myself as quote unquote, finishing it because
Right.
there's so much to do. It's not about just, mapping the hazards. It's also, I spend a lot of time talking to people personally about their experiences and trying to communicate people's experiences in their own words
Right.
because oftentimes the general public isn't getting to hear from incarcerated people about what the criminal justice system in the United States is really about and what it really does to people. And so I have really kind of a long-term career commitment to making impact in this space because it's so under-researched and under-resourced. But more broadly, I am interested in working with other organizations or other topics outside of the prison system. But more broadly, my passion lies with connecting with end users. Whether it's policymakers, advocacy organizations, communities, on how we can use geospatial data and geospatial technologies to improve how humans are interacting with the environment and human well-being in a changing climate.
Well, that is a fascinating a lifetime work of study that you'll be working on. That's just great, and it's neat to see the intersection of climate change and environmental concern and human ecology and how this is affecting so much more. Well, you wouldn't think in it maybe generally that it would be effective. Well, good luck to you in your future pursuits and your future research, and thank you for doing this, and congratulations again on the Baker Prize and the fellowship, and I can't think of a better person to get it than you, and we're glad that you're affiliated with the University of Arizona, because that's a good thing. We want to keep you around Tucson for a while.
I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me. It's great to chat today.
Great. Well, we celebrate wonder on Monday. We talk about great things that are happening at the University of Arizona, and obviously, Dr. Ovan Madai is an excellent example of good things happening at the University of Arizona in research and science and taking data and doing fun things with it to answer some questions which are important for all of us. So when we come back after the break, we'll have another segment with another doctor who is going to do some research that is going to be interesting to hear about in terms of human ecology as well. You're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI 1030 AM, The Voice, Tucson's local station, where we come back every day, Monday through Friday, 9 to 10, to talk about the good things happening in Tucson and celebrating success. Thank you, Doctor. We appreciate it, and Merry Christmas to you. And we'll bring you back after we get a little farther into your research, okay?
Thank you.
You're listening to Jump in Tucson. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. This is Dr. Ed Ackerley, your host. This is the Wonder Series, where we talk about the good things going on at the University of Arizona. With me in studio is my executive assistant, Morgan Murphy. Good morning, Morgan.
Good morning.
We've learned a few things. Lots of interesting things when we've talked to scientists from the University of Arizona. We're going to learn a little bit here today about amino acids and the infrastructure of life, the structure of life. With us, our guest is Dr. Joanna Maisel. She's a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Arizona. She's also an associate professor of ecology and evolutionary biology, has a doctor of philosophy from zoology from Oxford University, and she's also, we'll see if we can detect anything, she has a degree from the University of Melbourne, so we'll see if we can detect anything that signals us that you're from Melbourne. So good morning to you.
Good morning.
Yeah, there it is. You got that wonderful Australian accent. So how did you get to the University of Arizona? What was your educational journey? We kind of looked at that a little bit, but how did you get here and what's your responsibility at the U of A?
So I'm a professor in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology. I got here the way quite a few professors did, which is that my husband's also a professor.
Oh, yeah, right.
And the University of Arizona is really good at hiring couples. And when you hire couples and you make them both happy, it's really hard to leave because,
right.
You know, other universities will make you an offer, but they won't make both of you offers that you want to take. And
right.
So that's one way the university has really recruited and kept really good people.
Yeah, I've been at the Eller College for 35 years, and we have two groups that are husband and wife who actually teach in the same department. And so one was recruited, and they said, I'll come if I can bring my spouse. And we lucked out because we got two for the price of one recruiting visit, and we got these great couples. So you, at the University of Arizona, what kind of things do you look at? You teach, but you're also doing research. So what are you looking at in general?
So I'm interested in foundational questions in how evolution works. So why are systems so evolvable when they make, how are they robust to all the mistakes? How does it work at all, given the high rate of mistakes? How do the rates of mistakes evolve? You know, why are we still here when we, are under a crushing burden? Like, how does life work at all? That's a lot of my questions. But at the protein level, asking where do new proteins come from was actually what led me to this particular line of research. And how did proteins get started?
And so it is said that every form of life has a genetic code, and we kind of know what that genetic code is now. Took a while to get that, understand the genome and all that and figure out the structure. But all life basically has the same kind of genetic code, right?
That's right. There's a couple of small variations, but more or less. So the genetic code is just, DNA is made of G's, A's, T's, C's. It's a sort of a long string of letters. And it gets read in triplets. So GAA, GCT, And in those triplets, each of them can be translated into an amino acid. And those strings of amino acids, they're the proteins that do most of the physical work inside our cells. So the code is which triplet of nucleotides turns into which of the 20 amino acids.
Mm-hmm.
And to some degree, it's a code because it's kind of arbitrary. You could have different triplets doing different amino acids and it would still work.
Mm-hmm.
But life settled on one particular system for doing it.
Is that kind of part of the research of why did life settle on this particular arrangement, and that's kind of what the research is looking at to see if our thoughts on that over the years have come to fruition, or there's another way to look at it?
Yeah, so ever since we figured out what the genetic code was, which was soon after Watson and Crick had figured out the structure of DNA, there was a huge race to decode, how it coded for proteins. Enormous sort of, I think, one of the most amazing, breakthroughs in biology of the 20th century. After that, everyone kind of speculates, so how did it happen, But it was really just speculation, lots of thoughts of, it's better than random if you're looking at how robust it is to misreading, if you're looking, there's a variety of ways you could look at it and say, it's really very good how it's done. It's not quite perfect. We can think of better ways of doing it, but it's pretty good. Mm-hmm. You know, what was the process by which life settled on this? But it was all speculation. And so what we're trying to do is provide some data to tether that speculation. You know, people speculated as to what was early, what was late, and then they made up all these theories as to how that would happen. But if you actually got it wrong, which part was early and which is late, then all the theories about how you get from early to late are, of course, also going to be wrong.
Right, right. So you have to determine if some of those early research studies, whether they were founded on the principles that now that you, as you look back, it's easy to the armchair quarterback, as they say, on Monday morning and say, here's what we think now. But when they're in the thick of that research, it kind of seems like this is the way we're supposed to go. But you're maybe challenging some of those preconceived notions now that we accept as truth, and saying, let's look at this from a different perspective.
That's right. It was all very speculative. And I think mm-hmm. people thought that was all you could do to some degree. And we've shown that, no, it's not all you can do, that life forms today still retain hints of previous genetic codes of, you know, so basically what we did is we found proteins that were born before the code was even finished. So they use the early amino acids more and they use the late amino acids less because they're still formed. They're kind of 4 billion year old proteins. And then we look at proteins that are only 3 billion years old, but they were formed well after the code had been finished. And so they sort of more resemble normal, you know, modern proteins.
Right.
And by looking at the difference between those, we can use hard data taken from all the genomes that have been sequenced in recent decades. We can use that hard data to figure out which amino acids came early and which amino acids came late. And it wasn't what everyone expected.
Mm-hmm. Are you using AI to help you with this? Because it's just a massive data. It's a bunch of data, right? It's just a massive amounts of data. Are you teaching machines to get through this faster for you so you can?
Not really. No.
Not really.
You know, we use old-fashioned statistics.
Right.
Yeah, there's no AI. You know, there's places that
it's
AI.
It's human brains working on this, not machine learning, right?
No, there's lots of machines.
Yeah.
There's lots of computation. But yeah, it's human intelligence, not right. artificial intelligence.
And it's the asking of that question about the difference between the 4 billion year old and the 3 billion year old, that's the difference. And
that's right.
That's the focus, and try to make that that meaningful. You know, it's, and I just asked that question because it's mind-boggling, as you said, a mind-boggling, complicated process. And to have it evolve over time into this settling on this structure that is in place, it is mind-boggling, isn't it?
It is. I mean, it's certainly, you know, from a personal perspective with all that's happening in the world, and you get suddenly, oh, let me just sit back and look at us as a small blip and think about, you know, the 14 billion years of the universe and the 4.5 billion years of the Earth and the really major events that were taking place 4 billion years ago, and it puts everything in perspective.
Right.
And it's just amazing that we can say anything about it, that the data still exists, that things can be reconstructed, that as humans, we can actually learn this. I think, you know, talking about a state of wonder, like I'm right. still in a state of wonder that this was doable.
Right. And it's fascinating, too. Where do you find the 4 billion year old data? Where is that coming from? Fossilized remains or stardust, or where is it coming from?
No, so basically you just modern bacteria. And then modern, there's other things called archaea that might look a little bit like bacteria, but actually they last had a common ancestor with bacteria.
Oh, I see.
4 billion years ago.
Got it.
And so by, you know, we basically statistically reconstruct what the ancestor of these things that diverged 4 billion years ago must have looked like.
Interesting. Very interesting. When we come back after the break, we'll talk a little bit about sulfur and about amino acid protein sequences and LUCA and some other things. You're listening to Jump in Tucson, and we're going to go for a quick break and listen to some of our great sponsors, and then we'll come back and talk about the fascinating discussion of proteins and amino acid in the human body. You're listening to Jump in Tucson. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. This is our Monday Wonder Edition, where we talk about the good things going on in research and other things at the University of Arizona. Our guest is Dr. Joanna Maisel. She is a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Arizona. She's been there almost 10 years now, 2016?
20.
So almost two decades there, so that's a good thing. And we're glad you're still here and haven't flown the coop, as they say. Why is sulfur important to human life?
So forget about humans. Just
life
all
in general. All life in general, yeah.
So for early life, you know, what we found is, and other people have found, is sort of the core biochemistry that's in absolutely everything involves, among other things, methylating DNA, sort of adding bits. You know, you may have heard of epigenetics, and, you know, that epigenetics involves adding methyl groups often, for example. The way of doing that involves a cofactor, which is a molecule that's not DNA, it's not RNA, it comes from early life. It's called S-adenosylmethionine, it's called SAM for short. It's got sulfur in it. You know, sulfur is present in some of the most core biochemistry of life. Mm-hmm.
And that's why all life kind of has sulfur as one of its main ingredients. We talk about carbon and other things, but sulfur is really important.
Sulfur is really important. It's in two of the amino acids, methionine and cysteine. Mm-hmm. And related to methionine is this S-adenosylmethionine, which is, you know, this cofactor, like a vitamin, if you like, that's really needed for life. And so, you know, life all needs sulfur.
Right. So we talked a little bit about 4 billion years ago and 3 billion years ago and how you're comparing the different things to take us back to that beginning of the code. So tell us what LUCA is, L-U-C-A, LUCA.
LUCA is the cute little name we give for the last universal common ancestor. So the ancestor that, you know, between humans, plants, bacteria, archaea, every single living thing, although viruses are a bit special, we'll leave them out. But other than viruses, every single living thing traces back to a common ancestor. So 4 billion years ago, you know, there was one lucky organism or population or set of organisms that hit the jackpot, and it was the ancestor of everything that came after that. And whoever else didn't manage that went extinct. There was other life back then, but, you know, it didn't leave any descendants.
Right. And helping you in this this research that you're doing, your co-author of the recent study, is our good friend, Dante Loretta, who is a Regents Professor of Planetary Science and Cosmochemistry at the U of A Lunar and Planetary Laboratory. He's most known probably around these parts for the OSIRIS-REx mission, and he worked on that project and all the other good things he's doing at the Lunar and Planetary Lab. He was also one of the ones that talked about this sulfur-rich nature in astrobiology. That's you know, not only on Earth are we talking about this, but this could be transported elsewhere, correct?
Sure,
absolutely. Maybe. Who knows? Yeah. Who knows if there's life out there somewhere? The common thinking is there probably is, but who knows?
Yeah, so a lot of what we want to do is know where to look for that life. And to do that, you know, what we're often trying to look for is not something just like life today, but perhaps life 4 billion years ago or 3 billion years ago, that early life might be something that we should be looking for. So it's really, you know, it's helpful to know under what circumstances did early life come about.
And the OSIRIS-REx mission, one of the things that they were looking at and are looking at is where did we come from? Where did life start? How did it start? And if you're looking at an asteroid or comet as it comes through, some of that dates back to that very start of our solar system and the Earth and the beginnings of all that.
That's right. So just to be clear, there's no life on Bennu, right?
Yeah, you know? that we know of, right?
nobody's expecting life on Bennu.
But it's the remnants of that, right?
It's the raw materials.
Raw material. That's what I meant.
So the idea is that you're figuring out the raw materials. So the sort of the common interest we've had with the OSIRIS-REx mission is in amino acids.
Right.
So they're looking and seeing what amino acids do you have on an asteroid that's formed around the same time as our Earth, but that doesn't have life on it.
Right.
And we're...
That we know of.
Then we're looking in an evolutionary sense to say what amino acids did early life use.
Right.
In the past, people have, you know, there was an experiment in the 50s called the Miller-Urey experiment where they threw a bunch of raw materials together and some charge and tried and made some amino acids and say, look, they could be found. One of the problems with that experiment is they didn't add any, none of the ingredients had sulfur in them. Mm-hmm. So they said, oh, you can't get cysteine and methionine, but of course you couldn't because they didn't add any sulfur. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that sort of experiment is not a reliable way to figure out which amino acids would have been abundant.
Right.
But like which amino acids are on this asteroid is a much more reliable source of, you know, if it's on the asteroid, then it could have been available during the transition between life and non-life.
4 billion years ago.
Yeah.
Right, right. As part of, and so that's why the Bennu and the OSIRIS-REx mission is so important to maybe answer parts of that question with the sample that they've taken, and then will give us 20 or 30 years of research on that.
That's right. Although I just want to make, there's a difference. There's when life started,
right,
and then there's when the genetic code started.
Right.
And they're not the same things. And so one interesting thing is the ways in which our results are different.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, originally you got some kind of life. It's thought to have used, you know, RNA, which is a relative of DNA, maybe little peptides, but it couldn't make full proteins yet. And then the genetic code was a later innovation that allowed, you know, really reliable proteins to be made. And so it was this a later transition. And it's interesting. It could use things like histidine is one of the amino acids that's super useful but doesn't seem to be part of non-life. But histidine looks a lot like a nucleic acid like you find in DNA or RNA. So
right,
early life might have been making it, and that may have really helped the transition through to proteins.
I know this is just a blip in time, and 4 billion years is, again, not so long when you think about the 14 billion years and so forth, but what's the future look like for you in the research? Where do you go from here, and what are you looking for over the next, say, decade or so?
Oh, I think we can go a lot further. So we have a treasure trove now, mm-hmm, of proteins that we think are incredibly ancient. And I think, you know, we've got at least, you know, some over 100 sources of information about incredibly early life. And now here we actually do get some AI. Often it's very hard to figure out how they evolved 4 billion years ago because they're just so different from each other now that you can't tell them apart. But with AI has really allowed us to tell protein structures through AlphaFold. And that evolves much more slowly than protein sequences. Mm-hmm. And that's enabling all kinds of new methods to track the ancient evolution of these oldest proteins through looking at what was happening to their structures rather than just their sequences. And so I think we've got a lot of discoveries to make there.
You got a lot to look at over the next decade or so. Dr. Joanna Maisel, thank you so much. Maisel, thank you so much for being here today. She is a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Arizona, been there for 20 years, talking about amino acids and this thing we call life and how amazing it is and how complex it is, but again, how it has that common ancestry. So thank you for being with us today on Jump in Tucson, where we talk about Wonder on Monday, the good things going on at the University of Arizona. If you'd like to be on Jump in Tucson and you have something that you think that the community should hear about, go to jumpintucson.com, and perhaps you'll be sitting here talking to us about the good things that you're working on or the successes that you have in the community. Again, thank you again for coming this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you, Morgan, for being your bright, cheerful self in the morning. We appreciate that.
Of course, anytime.
Okay. This is KVY 1030 AM, The Voice, Tucson's only live local news and talk station, and you are listening to Jump in Tucson.